So good afternoon, and welcome to the 489th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Since its founding more than 40 years ago, the forum has been meeting monthly to hear from an invited speaker on a topic central to U.S. foreign policy. At today's meeting, we are pleased to have Mr. Blas Nunes Neto speaking on the status of asylum laws and practices. Blas Nunes Neto is a senior advisor at West Exec. He's a leading expert on homeland security, counterterrorism, immigration, and trade policy, with extensive management experience and a broad range of contacts in the executive branch, Capitol Hill, foreign governments, and the private sector. Mr. Nunes Neto served most recently in the Biden administration as the Deputy Assistant to the President and Senior Advisor for Migration and Southwest Border Coordination at the National Security Council. In that position, he coordinated the whole of government response to migration and border management and helped formulate national policies designed to address migratory flows. Prior to this appointment, he served as Assistant Secretary for Border and Immigration Policy and Acting Assistant Secretary for International Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security. He also held key leadership positions at U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the largest federal law enforcement agency, serving as the Chief Operating Officer and as a Senior Advisor to the Commissioner. Mr. Nunes Neto previously served as Associate Director and Senior Policy Researcher for the RAND Corporation's Homeland Security Operational Analysis Center. Additionally, he provided expert counsel for members of Congress as a senior professional staff member at the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, and as an analyst at the Congressional Research Service. So he's got a lot of good cred when it comes to issues related to migration and asylum. He holds an MA in Government Administration and a BA in Political Science and English from the University of Pennsylvania. Blas, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you, George. Thank you, George, to the Midcoast Forum for the invitation to speak with all of you here today on a topic which I think is obviously extraordinarily timely and important given all of the events of the last few years. Like many Americans, I think I've spent the last 10 years kind of amazed at how the politics around immigration have turned increasingly polarized and in many respects, I think, politically toxic. And I've been kind of wondering how it is that we got to this place, because it wasn't too long ago, in fact, when I started my career at the Congressional Research Service, that President George W. Bush, a Republican, put forward an immigration reform proposal that at the time garnered both Democratic and Republican votes for and Democratic and Republican votes against. That is, it was not a polarizing issue in the way that it's become since then. Unlike most Americans, I've spent much of the last 10 to 15 years at the epicenter of policy making and policy formulation on border and immigration issues, and so I've had a front row view to what's happened. So I thought I would start by going back in time a little bit. And for those of you on the radio, I'm presenting some slides and I will talk you through them. This first slide shows a sign that you can still see on some highways in Southern California, and it represents a family crossing the highway. And so back in the 80s and early 90s in Southern California, it was a regular occurrence that people would stream across the border, particularly in the San Ysidro port of entry near San Diego, and they would kind of run across the freeways, and it was very dangerous, right? So it was so common and so dangerous that the state of California put these signs up on the highways. And at least as of a few years ago, when I was last in Southern California, you could still see some of these signs. So back then, there was a large perception that border crossings were out of control. And so we'll go to the next slide, and it shows illegal crossings, really encounters, apprehensions on our southwest border going back many decades, all the way back to the 60s. And what you will see is that in the mid-80s to early 90s, we had this big surge of immigration where we were encountering at the border almost 1.8 million people a year. But back then, keep in mind, the Border Patrol only had a couple thousand agents. So they were making 1.8 million encounters. It is almost certain that the number of people crossing was actually much higher than that. And that led to, early in the Clinton administration in 1992, a large effort to increase border enforcement. We invested a lot of money in the Border Patrol all through the 90s, and the staffing for the Border Patrol went up very fast. And you can see that initially on this slide, it worked a little bit. Encounters went down through most of the 90s. But by the late 90s, early 2000s, they increased again. What changed, though, was we had, throughout the 90s, invested in a lot of infrastructure and technology. We built a large barrier or wall along the border in California, in San Diego. You can still see it, obviously, to this day. And we built barriers in El Paso. We call that strategy prevention through deterrence in the early 90s. And the idea that you can deter illegal entries by putting a lot of resources on the border really started back then in the early 90s and continues to this day to be more or less the organizing principle that we use to secure the border. But in the early 2000s, we had another surge of immigration. And this surge was different in that it was focused in Arizona. In the deserts of Arizona, right? And that was a much more dangerous place for migrants to cross because it's very inhospitable terrain. It's very remote. There are mountains, there's deserts. It can take many days of walking through the desert to reach a highway or a town. But it was the least fortified part of the border at the time. And so migrants and smugglers focused their crossings there. That changed a lot of the, I think, politics around this, in that historically, most of the migrants who crossed in California and in Texas, and there were large communities on both sides of the border there that were used to seeing a lot of immigration. In Arizona, you didn't have that. And so people got really increasingly upset about what was happening. And once again, 2000 came around, there was a large sense that the border was out of control, that immigration was out of control. And so we had, once again, we invested a lot of money on securing the border. We created, some of you may remember, a virtual fence, they called it back then, called SBI Net, where we invested a lot of money in putting cameras and towers and radars in the desert. And we pledged to double the Border Patrol in size once again. And so you can see from this graph that initially it didn't super work. We still had high levels of encounters for a few years. But then towards the middle of the 2000s into the 2014-15 timeframe, we went through this prolonged lull in migration at the border. Why is that? Well, I think for two reasons. I think one is, in 1996, we concluded the NAFTA agreement with Mexico. And keep in mind that up until 2000, 98% of our encounters at the border were Mexican nationals. So almost all of that big wave of migration you see on this chart in the 90s, really the 80s, the 90s, and the 2000s were Mexicans coming across the border largely to do seasonal labor in the United States. 2001 happened. We had, obviously, 9/11. A lot of focus on securing the border, a lot of investments on securing the border. But we also had Mexico starting to really become a middle-income country, right? Generating a lot of job opportunities for Mexicans to stay in Mexico. And so the combination of increased enforcement at the border, the Border Patrol, again, doubled in size once again, We invested a lot in building barriers along the border, fences, and technology. But, and it's a big but, the push factors that were pushing Mexicans to come to the United States went down as well. And so we had this prolonged lull at the border throughout really all of the Obama administration until the very end. Towards the end of the Obama administration, we started to see another surge in migration, but it was different. It was no longer Mexican nationals. Instead, it was Central American nationals, predominantly from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. But not just nationals of those countries, unaccompanied children. And this was the first wave around the 2014 timeframe of unaccompanied children arriving at our border, followed in 2016 by a wave of family units coming to the border, again from Central America. Those demographics are the most complicated and vulnerable to deal with at the border, right? Keep in mind, our Border Patrol infrastructure at the time had been built in the 60s, 70s, and 80s when all of our migrants were single adult males from Mexico. And all of a sudden, we were trying to take care of small children in Border Patrol facilities that were simply not set up to do that, right? But why is that? Why did the families start to come? And then I think just to finish this chart, you'll see obviously we had a large increase during the first Trump administration in the 2018-19 timeframe. And again, that was driven almost predominantly by families from Central America. We had a huge decrease during the pandemic when borders shut down all over the world. And then during the Biden administration, when I was in the administration, we had this just huge surge of migration once again. Why is it that we keep having these surges? Why do people keep coming? That's obviously the billion, $170 billion question these days. One of the reasons, I think, is that our immigration laws have not been updated since the early 1990s. So during the Reagan administration in 1986, there was a famous amnesty, that legislation that was passed that provided amnesty for people living in the United States. And the idea at the time, 1986, was that by regularizing the status of people here and investing in resources at the border, that we were going to stop illegal immigration. As you saw from that chart before, that didn't super work out, right? And that, I think, has informed a lot of the debate over the years. But why is it that people keep coming? One of them is that our, when you think about migrants who are coming to the border from Central America or South America, these days, because of how much we've hardened the border and because of how dangerous the trip is, almost all of them hire smugglers. And the average cost of a smuggler these days is $10,000 to $14,000. That's a lot of money, right? Why would someone coming from a fairly poor country sell everything they own, go into debt with family members maybe, to pay $14,000 for a smuggler to come to the United States? And I think the obvious answer is that they generally do it because they believe they're going to be able to stay when they arrive. And in fact, that is generally what's been happening. And it's because smugglers and migrants have figured out that our asylum system is, in effect, a backdoor labor migration program. We do not have enough legal pathways for migrants to come. Again, we talked about legislation was last passed in the 80s and early 90s. That legislation established all of our labor pathways, including H-1B visas, things folks probably have heard in the news. All of those pathways have statutory caps. They have limits that were established by Congress 30 to 40 years ago. They have not been touched since, right? And so they are insufficient to meet the demand in the United States for labor and the demand for migration to the United States. And so in the absence of an orderly legal pathway, migrants have figured out that they can come to the border, they can claim asylum, and we go through a rigorous screening process historically at the border called expedited removal, where people have to be interviewed by an asylum officer. Well, historically, when we set up our asylum system, it was again in the 80s, when our big concern was people, you know, coming from the Soviet Union, people coming from Cuba, we intentionally set up our asylum system to operate kind of like a big funnel. We're at the top, the first interview, we wanted to err on the side of assuming most people had a credible claim to asylum. We call credible fear. At the end of the process, when they go in front of an immigration judge, the bar to achieving asylum is actually quite high, right? You have to demonstrate that you are subject to persecution for your political beliefs or a protected social status or torture, right? That's a high bar. And so historically, when we've gone through the, looking at numbers from 2014 to 2019, right before the pandemic, and I like to do that because the pandemic really kind of changed things in ways we can talk about. But historically, from 2014 to 2019, when we did that first screening interview at the border, 83% of people were found to have a credible fear, 4 in 5. When they're found to have a credible fear, they have to go before an immigration judge. That's a process that, by law, is supposed to take 6 months. Today, it takes about 4.5 years to conclude, right? So we have to release people at that point because we've never had enough detention beds to hold everybody through that whole process. At the end of that whole process, only about 25% of the people who go through it receive some grant of protection, whether it's asylum or what we call withholding of removal or some other kind of protection, right? And so the system is not working, right? It's forcing us to release people at the border who do not have a credible, an actual claim to protection. It's forcing people who do have a credible claim to protection to wait years and years and years in limbo before they actually receive that protection, right? And I think almost as importantly, I like to say that today we live in what I call like a total information awareness environment at the border, right? Migrants and smugglers know what's happening at the border before we do. They all have phones, they all have WhatsApp, they are communicating constantly, right? So during the Biden administration, as folks may remember, this is an anecdote I like to tell, we had a large surge of migration coming through the Darien jungle between Panama and Colombia, which is so remote that they've never been able to build a road through it. And it's so rugged that it was called the tapón, or the cork, because people just couldn't traverse it. Well, the smugglers turned it into a highway of sorts, right? Because they figured there was, they learned there was money to be made there. And migrants go through this week-long trek in the Darien to cross it and get to Panama. And when they come out of the Darien, many of them somehow already know what's happening on our border. During the Biden administration, we were forced to re-implement the Remain in Mexico program, the migrant protection protocols, by a court. And I had a colleague who had been traveling for the State Department in Panama and was at the Darien when that happened, when that court ruling came out. And that same day, a woman who had come out of the Darien with her family went up to her when she found out she was part of the U.S. government and asked her whether it was true that we had restarted the Remain in Mexico program, right? So people know what's happening on our border sometimes better than we do. So the next slide shows our immigration court backlog. And you can see, for those of you who are listening, that it looks like an exponential curve heading up. Our backlog has grown from about 500,000 cases 10 years ago to more than 4 million cases this year. And that means there are 4 million cases still making their way through the immigration court process. Again, a process that was taking 4.5 years on average to conclude last year. That's before, I should add, the current Trump administration has laid off hundreds of immigration judges. So that backlog is almost certainly going to continue to grow. We have a huge backlog. We're resolving fewer cases than ever before. Right, the next slide shows the percent of immigration court cases that are resolved each year. And it's not a good story in any way, shape, or form in that, you know, even in 2012, only about 30% of immigration court cases got decided each year. That's not great. Again, keep in mind, the statutory requirement is 6 months to conclude an immigration court process. As of, you know, a couple years ago, we were below 20%. Right, so if you're only resolving 20% of cases a year, you can see why we have a backlog of millions of cases. Why is it? Why can't we resolve these cases faster? One of the reasons is that when we've had these surges in migration, 1990, 2000, you know, 2017 under the first Trump administration, Congress has gotten together and put a lot of money towards securing the border. Right? We have this kind of national Groundhog Day moment where we all get concerned that the border is not secure, and our first reaction is we're going to, you know, give a lot of money to the Border Patrol. And that's good, because the Border Patrol has a tough job, and they do need more resources. We've never resourced the rest of the system in the same way. We have not resourced the immigration courts sufficiently, clearly, right? We've tried to hire immigration judges a little bit. We've never had the same concerted effort to increase the back end of the system in the same way that we've resourced the front end of the system. So you've got a lot of Border Patrol agents, they're making apprehensions, but guess what? Those people have to go through a process that involves other agencies. And we have not funded those other agencies the way we've needed to, going back decades. So this is not a current administration issue. This is a bipartisan, presidents of both political parties have just failed to do that, going back, you know, 20, 30 years. The other part of the system is what we call the affirmative asylum system, and that is, so people who are encountered at the border generally go through expedited removal or end up in front of an immigration judge in what we call an adversarial process, where they're prosecuted by the government for an illegal entry. People who either are not encountered at the border, right, they got away, or maybe they flew in from on a plane on a visa and then overstayed their visa, they can apply affirmatively. And that puts them in front of an asylum officer from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. So that's another way people can claim asylum. The next chart shows you how the backlog at USCIS in affirmative asylum also looks a little bit like an exponential curve, right? So from 2019, our filings were about 100,000 cases a year. 2024, 2025 were over 400,000 filings a year. Our completions, the number of cases we complete, is unfortunately not an exponential curve. It's a very, very small number each year. And so that backlog has just continued to increase over time. Right, so we are not adjudicating nearly enough of these cases each year. And again, it's because U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services has very few asylum officers on board, and we've never resourced that function the way we should. Right. So when we think about border security, we need to think about the whole system, not just what's happening on the border, which one of my former bosses in the Senate would say, you know, what happens at the border is a symptom, it's not the cause, right? And when you cure the symptom, you're not curing the cause. But, you know, we're not the only ones that have gone through this. Our partners in the European Union have seen a similar surge in asylum claimants over the last really 10 to 15 years. Very famously, during the Libya war, there was a large wave of migration to Europe about 10 years ago. And while the numbers decreased after that, they're now increasing again. And so, again, they have very similar problems, or I think challenges, maybe a better way to say it, than we do. Their asylum systems do not grant asylum to everybody, but, and it's a but, once people are in the process, and it takes, you know, a while to go through the process, and they're found not to have, not to receive asylum, in the EU, they've been really struggling to return them to their home countries, right? And that's the last part of the process. And frankly, that's true here in the United States as well. So we talked about the length of the court process, right? 4.5 years. Only about 25% of people get protection at the end of that. What happens to the rest of those folks? The folks that are ordered removed by an immigration judge after a 4+ year-long process. Well, at that point, they're in the interior of the United States, right? They have maybe had US citizen children. They have jobs, they're in our communities. It's really hard to remove people when they form ties in our communities, right? And it's a, you know, one of the thorniest, I think, public policy debates. I think you're seeing this current administration take a very maximalist approach to interior immigration enforcement. In the past, we've tried to focus only on, you know, serious or violent criminals in the interior. Certainly under the Biden administration, that was the policy. But it's a tough question, right? We are supposed to be a nation of laws. And, you know, having a system where people go through a years-long process to get, you know, and ultimately are found not to have a credible claim, not to merit asylum or protection, you know, you would, I think most Americans would agree that to have a lawful process, you would have to have a removal at the end of that process. But that is not what has been happening in our system, and I think it's part of the reason why the politics around immigration have become so toxic in this country. I like to joke that in the EU, and I want to preface this by saying it kind of hurts me to say this, because anyone who's worked a lot with the EU knows how slow they are to do things, how long it takes them to do things, how diplomatically complicated it can be to coordinate with the Europeans. But in the EU, they are in some respects a more functioning democracy than we are, where when they have faced this immigration and asylum challenge 10 years ago, most of their member countries updated their laws, and they are currently negotiating an EU-wide compact on migration and asylum that addresses a lot of the things we talked about, right? It will lead to faster procedures. It's going to include provisions that will make it easier for the EU to remove people at the end of the process. You know, some of these, again, may be somewhat controversial among advocates on the left, such as safe third countries and the like. But they're changes that are meant to deal with the legal issues, the statutory challenges in their system that make it hard for the system to function correctly. In the United States, we have been completely unable to address these issues now going back decades, right? Most famously, obviously, last year, there were negotiations in the Senate that would have, I think, significantly strengthened our asylum system, made it, you know, more fit for purpose and tougher, frankly, that fell apart, you know, purely for political reasons. So why is that exactly? Why can't we in the United States solve this problem? You know, why can't we get Congress to act? I think there's a few reasons for this. And for those of you who are listening online, I put a picture up of a famous picture from the early 2000s that shows an SUV stuck on top of the wall at the border, right? And so we have, you know, President Trump very famously pledged that he was going to build a wall between the United States and Mexico. You know, on, I think, many on the left opposed building walls on the border. I think the wall at the border is frankly, I might get in trouble for saying this, it's the single dumbest policy debate we have in the United States. There's no doubt that we need walls and barriers in some parts of the border, right? Walls, however, don't stop people from crossing, right? They don't stop SUVs from crossing, right? So we build them, we want to build them, in parts of the border that are urban or suburban, where once people cross, we only have a few seconds or maybe minutes to make an apprehension before they disappear into a community, right? It makes sense to build them there because walls don't stop people from crossing, they slow them down, right? It does not make sense to build a wall in the middle of the desert or on a mountain, right? Because it doesn't matter how much you slow them down. It's still going to take them days or longer to walk to a town or a road where they can effectively get away, right? But the build the wall, don't build the wall debate, again, is reductionist, right? I think it became kind of shorthand for, you know, President Trump and many on the right for like, we are serious about securing the border. And it baited Democrats to say, we don't want to build a wall, which many Americans took to mean we don't want to secure the border. And neither of those positions is actually viable, right? We can't build a wall across the whole border, even if we want to paint it black. But, you know, we do need wall in some parts of the border. And so early in the Biden administration, when I was visiting the border, we had parts of the border that had gaps in the wall where we had to line up Border Patrol agents to make sure people couldn't sneak through those gaps 24/7. Right behind those gaps, we had the material we needed to complete the wall just rusting on the ground, right? But President Biden had made a campaign pledge not to build wall, and so it took a few years for us to come up with a process to, you know, sanction the filling of all of these gaps in the wall. And again, just a really short-sighted commitment from my standpoint that was made. So we keep having the same debate in this country about securing the border, but our politics have become much more polarized, right? And I think part of the reason is, again, on the historical efforts to pass immigration reform, split both parties in half, right? On the left, we've always had kind of an advocacy community that wants more migration, that resists enforcement at the border and the like. But we also had labor unions who at the time, 20 years ago, opposed most immigration reform efforts because they were worried about undercutting wages. And on the right, we've always had the nativist wing, the Stephen Miller wing of the Republican Party, right, that doesn't want migration at all. But we also had the Chamber of Commerce Republicans, right, who wanted legal immigration, wanted to fill jobs in the United States, and have supported that. Today, that center of our politics has no voice in the immigration debate, right? When we debate these issues, it has become either what I would call the advocacy community on the left speaking for many Democrats, and then the Stephen Miller wing on the right speaking for many Republicans. But when you poll, most Americans don't agree with either of those perspectives, right? Most of we are a nation of immigrants. I'm an immigrant. I came to the United States from Argentina when I was 10, and I had the great honor last year on the 4th of July, which is my birthday, to oversee a naturalization ceremony at in Mount Vernon, right? And it was just a incredibly fulfilling thing for me to do, to be able to stand in front of new citizens and tell them that, you know, welcome them to the United States after all of the things it takes to become a naturalized citizen, and tell them that, you know, the American dream is a real thing. It's hard, right? But in the United States, we are one of the few countries where someone like me, an immigrant, can end up working at the highest levels of government, right? That doesn't happen in many countries. We are unique, I think, in that, and we need to hang on to it. And I think most Americans appreciate those stories. Most Americans are proud of our heritage as an immigrant country. But that's not what you're seeing in the news today, right? And it's because the debate has become really dominated by the extremes on the left and the right. And so what we need to do is find ways to connect with the average American who doesn't want chaos at the border, right? And we in the Biden administration, you know, we failed in that. We had chaos at the border. But most Americans, they don't want cruelty in the interior either, right? And I think this administration is failing on that score, right? What they're doing in the interior is just wantonly cruel, and cruel by design. And I think most Americans don't like that either. We need rational policies that involve securing the border. We cannot have chaos at the border. And we need to remove people who are here illegally, who have had their day in court, who've gone through a years-long process and been ordered removed. And that's hard. It's a hard conversation, but it's one we need to have as a country, because otherwise we're going to keep having this pendulum swing back and forth and not stopping in the middle where it really needs to be. So I will stop there. I'm happy to take questions.
I think you've pointed out some really tough problems to do it. I wonder, while we're collecting questions from the audience here, I'd like to ask you to go into a little more about how we can perhaps influence the push aspect of this. You said that people are leaving because of a lot of economic reasons as well as because they're dangerous. I know at the beginning of the administration, Vice President Harris was touted as the person to do this. Is that a partial solution to this problem, if we can help the people who are migrating?
Sure. So I think that's a great question. And historically, there's really two ways to look at migration. There are factors that push people, like you mentioned, to migrate. The things that lead someone to leave their home country to want to go to a new country, which is a hard decision for someone to make, right? And those things are generally economic opportunity or persecution, right? People who are under threat, or just countries that are in conflict, right? Where people don't feel safe, right? Those are more or less the three big factors: employment opportunity, safety, and potential persecution. And we should absolutely be working on that in our region. We've had long efforts, you know, to help countries improve on those three things over the years. I think the challenge is, frankly, that working on push factors takes decades, right? It is not a quick fix to help a country like, for example, Guatemala become safer, more economically vibrant, and less, you know, corrupt, right? That takes a long, long time to happen. And migration is something that happens today, right? And so I think what, you know, this administration has done with USAID as an example is extremely short-sighted. We need to be investing in helping countries in our region become more stable, become economically more vibrant. And so that work is crucial. But the other part of the equation is the pull factors, like why people come here, right? And I think there, you know, my theory of the case, as I described today, is that our asylum system has really become kind of a backdoor immigration, labor immigration process, right? And this administration has, in the Biden administration, we addressed both the pull factors and the push factors. You mentioned Vice President Harris spent a lot of time in Central America, found billions of dollars to support economic growth there. We also implemented policies at the border to restrict asylum while also creating lawful processes for people to come to the U.S. The Trump administration is clearly only focused on the pull factor, right? And they are essentially curtailing all access to asylum at the border in ways that I think are not in line with our laws, right? That's all being litigated. It will likely go to the Supreme Court. We'll see what happens there. But in the bigger story, and I know I'm going long, is that in the absence of congressional action, we've seen presidents of both political parties going back 15 years now trying to solve this issue through executive actions. Those executive actions all get challenged by the left and the right in court, sometimes by both at the same time, like we had in some of our cases. And it's brought the courts in, where you have courts dictating what happens at the border in ways that are deeply unfortunate, right? So the short answer to this is, like, there is no solution to this that doesn't involve Congress doing its job. And as Americans, I think we should all be holding Congress accountable.
Let me follow up a little bit on that. Because you said we need rational policies and a change in the law. Yep. Are there some what are your views on some specific things that we should be doing in our legislation?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the framework that was negotiated in the Senate last year is a good starting point when it comes to our asylum system. And keep in mind, you know, the comprehensive immigration reform efforts that we talked about under George W. Bush and under President Obama, they would not have fixed our asylum system. They didn't really touch our asylum system. So even if they had passed, we would likely still have the same problem on our border, right? So we need to fix the asylum system again, adjudicate these cases in weeks, not years, ensure that the people who need protection get it quickly, but that the people who don't qualify for protection get removed quickly. We need more legal pathways, right? We have a lot of demand for labor in the United States that is not met. And so, you know, we need more legal options for people to come here, is two. And then three, and this is the hardest part, we need, to figure out what we're going to do with the millions of people that have been in the United States for 10, 15, 20 years plus, who have U.S. citizen spouses, U.S. citizen children. Most people say, why can't they just become legal? And it's because there's no path for them under our current statutes to do that, right? And so we need to have a tough conversation politically about what we do about those folks.
You commented on both the length of time it takes to adjudicate these cases and the fact that the number of judges has been increased. How can we get more judges and the immigration staff? I mean, isn't this something that Congress should focus on as much as they do on border protection?
Right. This is not a new issue, right? I think there's a lot of concern about what this administration is doing with our immigration judges. But, you know, we have not adequately funded our asylum corps at U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services or our immigration judges at the Executive Office of Immigration Review at the Department of Justice for decades now, right? And that has limited our ability to adjudicate cases quickly. And it's because it's very easy when we're in the middle of a crisis at the border to focus on the Border Patrol and ICE and Customs and Border Protection. We've done that now in the 90s, the 2000s, the 2010s, and we're doing it again now. Whenever we do that, we fail to provide adequate resources for the rest of the system. So we would probably comfortably need to triple our asylum corps and our immigration judges to start making a dent. And the Senate bill last year did that. It provided really large amounts of resources for the rest of the system to have a functioning system. So that's a good starting point, I think, for any efforts moving forward.
And somebody wanted to know what reason the Trump administration has given for firing so many of the administrative judges.
So
what's the rationale?
I think I'm not in the administration, right? So this is just me speculating. But, you know, I think there's a belief among some in the Trump administration that many immigration judges are too permissive. They're too liberal in their decisions. And so I think they are conducting a purge, based solely on how many cases these judges are granting, and they want to hire judges that are going to be tougher, in their adjudications. And I think that is deeply unfortunate for any number of reasons, which is, we want judges to be following the law, and we do not want the administration to be putting its thumb on the scales when it comes to these adjudications, right? And if someone merits asylum, they should get it. We have a long-standing commitment in this country to offering protection to people who need it, and I think it's most Americans, would agree that someone who arrived and actually would be subject to persecution or torture in their house, in their home country, should not be removed to their home country.
That is a broad question, but how do we detoxify the public policy debate? Why it's gotten so bad? Give us that, simple answer for how we're going to fix this.
That's a great and tough question, right? I think this is not the only policy sphere where the loudest voices are the extremes on the left and the right. And I think, what we need is for, the folks who are, in the middle 60% of this country, to pay more attention to these issues and to hold their members of Congress, again, accountable when they fail to act, on issues that are so clearly important to the well-being of our politics and our country. I think absent pressure on Congress from, the average American who is wondering why we keep having these surges, why do we keep having these crises, what can we do about it, we need to, put the finger where it belongs, which is our members of Congress, and we need to hold them accountable.
So here's two sides of a coin, but related questions in a way. One is ICE presently deporting people with pending asylum cases, i.e. not going through the normal
There have certainly been news stories that suggest that's happening. Again, I'm not in the administration, so I don't know. There's a whole range of reasons why someone could be removed, and something this administration is doing a lot is removing people to third countries, right? So you may have a colorable claim of asylum for your home country, but you probably won't have it for a third country, a different country. And under our laws, you can be removed to a third country. And so they're, using that pretty liberally. Now, they're using it in ways that I think are unfortunate and they're, that are frankly not lawful. But that's one of those one of those issues where we need to be very careful about what we oppose and how strongly we oppose it, because we will always need the ability to remove some people to third countries. We did it under the Biden administration. We've done it historically, right? Now, maybe we shouldn't be sending them to a prison in El Salvador where they're clearly going to be subjected to inhumane activities, right? Maybe we shouldn't send them to active war zones like Sudan, but we should embrace the concept of safe third countries, and really I would say not even safe third countries but safer third countries. So historically under refugee asylum laws, you can designate a country as a safe third country and they can you can require that people go through their asylum process in that country. That is actually sanctioned by international law, right? Now, historically, we've held those safe third countries to really, really high standards, to basically our only safe third countries with Canada, right? And I would have conversations with the State Department about other countries in our region, and they would say things like, the only safe country in our region is Canada. Now, I'm from Argentina originally, right? That is an incredibly paternalistic perspective on our hemisphere, right? The real question isn't, is Argentina as safe as the United States, right? It's like, is Argentina safer for that migrant than the country they're fleeing, right? Same thing with Guatemala, with El Salvador, with any of these countries, right? If you're a Haitian who's fleeing the just epic, dissolution of the state in Haiti and the gang warfare, you know, almost any country in the region is safer for you than Haiti, right? And so we need to rethink how we approach some of these issues, I think.
And a follow-up to that is there a method of accountability to countries where we send these? I know we vet them in advance, but what if they're not treating people the way we think they should once they get there?
Well, I think under a functioning system, absolutely you would want to make sure that the countries you're sending people to are not engaging in you know, torture, persecution, or other negative things on the people they're receiving. This administration is clearly not doing that, right? In fact, I think they're almost by design, again, because cruelty is a bit the point of their policies, sending them to places where they're going to have a really hard time. But I think in any future administration that is really trying to solve these issues for the long run, I think you would want to make sure that you're, again, not holding them to U.S. standards, because we're one of one, or even EU standards. But, you know, is that place a safer location for that person to be than the place they're fleeing from? And look, under international law, migrants have an obligation themselves to claim asylum in the country that's closest to where they're fleeing from, right? Asylum forum shopping, as it's called, is really not something we should be sanctioning. Migrants themselves, if they are actually fleeing persecution, have some obligation to, you know, find protection as close to their home country as they can. Now, most migrants want to come here or Europe, right? And it's because we're safe, but it's also for economic reasons, right? And I think we just need to have an honest appraisal of all of these things.
So after 4.5 years, someone gets asylum.
Yeah.
Then what? Is there a path to citizenship at that point, or are they just in limbo?
Yes, when you are granted asylum, you can adjust status to legal permanent residency and eventually become a U.S. citizen. Now, it's the kind of first part of the process. It can take years to get to the end. But yeah, I think it's, you know, and we have always historically done that because we have not wanted to create what we call a second class of citizens, right? People who are here but don't have the full privileges of a U.S., of a pathway to citizenship. I will say, you know, for many undocumented people, while they would obviously want to be U.S. citizens if they could, just feeling safe and protected from, losing their jobs and being deported would go a long way. Right, and so that's something to think about. This administration, unfortunately, has taken, a maximalist view to this, right? They've just ceased all asylum adjudications. They're talking about denaturalizing U.S. citizens, right, which is something we've done in extraordinarily rare cases, usually involving espionage in the past. All of these things, I think, are not great.
Then here's kind of the, I had it here a second ago. At the other side of this, both parties are very aware of how potential new citizens might vote. Could we benefit from a system of granting permanent residence but no path to citizenship?
It's a good question. I think, I kind of hinted at that in my previous answer, where I think, on the right, there's this. Conspiracy theory called Great Replacement Theory, right? That migrants, that the left is letting all these immigrants in because the left wants people who are going to vote for them, and that all of these undocumented immigrants are voting, and that's just not true. There's no all of the investigations into non-citizen voting have turned up, you know, rounding error numbers of people who are voting, like dozens, not millions, right? But I think there is, I think many Americans look at people who came here illegally, and even if they've been here for a long time, even if they have U.S. citizen spouses, even if they have jobs, I think to some Americans it seems like rewarding bad behavior to have a system where we would allow those folks to become U.S. citizens. On the left, when we've had efforts to do immigration reform, a pathway to citizenship has been kind of a third rail for Democrats, right? They will not countenance a system that does not include that. But again, I think what that's meant in practice is we have a large, you know, 10, 15 million people here, probably 10 or 11 if you're actually using real numbers, here illegally, in the shadows, you know, many of whom have been here for decades. They don't have work authorization. They're using, I think to those people, a system that allows them to stay here and work legally that falls short of a pathway to citizenship would probably be appealing to many of them compared to what they have today, right? And so I think we need to really, have a long, hard conversation around what we do around those folks. I do not believe that the president, you know, Trump's commitment to reverse migration, right, to making things so miserable for people who are here illegally that they'll all go back home of their own volition. I just don't see that as a viable thing. I think when you see what people go through to come here, like I've been to the Darien, I've seen firsthand what it looks like there, and people who are willing to do that, they're not going to go home just because we're making things a little difficult, right? And so we need to come up with a better path.
Then the president's been complaining or been saying recently that we only want people who can assimilate into our society to come. Are immigrants less willing to assimilate now than in prior times? If so, why? And isn't this leading to polarization?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. From my standpoint, and again, I'm a naturalized U.S. citizen. We came here when I was a kid from South America. You know, I think assimilating is hard, and it can take a couple generations for people to really go through the process, right? But we have a long history in the United States of, you know, waves of immigration from all different parts of the world, right? And that first generation is always going to, you know, have most, you know, be mostly associated with where they came from, right? But like their kids and grandkids are all U.S., solidly part of our culture. And we have a huge advantage over, I think, almost any other country in the world in that our concept of what it means to be an American includes a lot of different things, right? We have, you can be black and be American, you can be Latino and be American, you can be, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant and be American. Europe is struggling with that because their national identities are much more tied up culturally in a certain, ethnicity or a certain religion or a certain, background than we have here in the United States. We are, by definition, an immigrant country, right? And so I think that's a bit of a trap question because I think, I think when you look at the long arc of our history, all of these migrants eventually assimilate and become kind of part of our social fabric, and it makes us stronger.
Then I want to return to that 4.5 years that people need to wait.
Yeah.
And during that 4.5 years, what is the rationale for delaying when asylum seekers may be hired to work? Not being able to work makes them more dependent upon receiving handouts.
Well, so actually when you are in, and maybe I should have said this a little more pointedly, but 6 months after you apply for asylum, you are actually legally authorized to apply for work authorization, for employment authorization. So most people who are in that process are actually work authorized, right? And so because precisely for that reason, we don't want them to become a public charge. But that, perversely, as I mentioned, I think, is also part of the pull factor that brings people here, right? Because while they're here, they can work. It's why they will pay $15,000 to a smuggler, because if they know they can work for 4 or 5 years, you know, you can pay that off and make some money. And even if you have to go back to your home country, at that point, you know, you will have made more money and be able to set yourself up there.
So let me finish by asking, are there any champions in Congress for sensible migration, immigration reform?
Yes. I think I think there's a number of members that have good ideas. I think Ruben Gallego from Arizona has put forward, a plan that is pretty sensible. I think Veronica Escobar from Texas in the House also has done a lot of thinking on this. I think there are many members who are reasonable on these issues and have a sense of where we need to go. I think it's really a question of getting the political leadership on the left and the right to kind of sanction those efforts, right? And I think it's, as with many things in our Congress these days, I think if you had a blind vote, right, a blind vote on a sensible immigration proposal in the House and the Senate, I would be surprised if it didn't pass by a pretty healthy majority, right? But we don't have blind votes. People have to own their votes in this country, and I think, that's for a good reason. And so members are unwilling to do that. Again, but that's because they fear the backlash, not in their general elections, but in their primaries, right? And so until we solve that issue politically, we're going to struggle with this.
Well, thank you very much. Very appreciate it.
Thank you all. This has been great.